Happy Saturday. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. So let me tell you about the show today. First of all, do you know what day this is? June 6th? June 6th is a 71-year anniversary of the invasion of Normandy, folks. A turning point in world history. And probably the peak of the process of maturing of what we know as the greatest generation. Millions of men, hundreds of thousands storming the beaches that day. Five beaches: Sword, Gold, Juneau, Omaha, Utah. Omaha and Utah were the American beaches. Sword and Gold and Juneau were the Canadian and British beaches. And there were French commandos involved, too. The 101st Airborne went in gliders to take control of major bridges across the waterways that crisscrossed Normandy so that German tanks couldn't reinforce the beachheads. The 82nd Airborne parachuted in to do much the same, but their job was to hold key crossroads and towns. They overshot their mark, or at least a battalion of them did, and landed in St. Miraglisse, resulting in a slaughter. It's an amazing piece of history. The greatest armada of warships, battleships, military vessels ever assembled in the history of the planet. And it all came down to the gutsy decision to go, despite fears of bad weather, a moon that was a little bit too bright, choppy seas and heavy currents in the English Channel, and of course the invasion at Normandy, the widest point in the channel, where the Germans had expected it and Hitler had insisted it would occur, at Calais, the narrowest part of the channel. Huge risks on every level, yet one man, Dwight Eisenhower, said go, with literally the fate of the civilized world hanging on that decision. You know, that's guts. That's good old American guts. And the brave men and women who stormed the beaches that day and parachuted in inky blackness and bad weather, crashed their gliders in hedgerows. They're dying off now. Thousands per day. Many are in their 90s. So, who do we have to replace them? I'm going to be talking about that a little bit later in the show. Because one of the things the greatest generation did for us is leave us a better world, a better country, a more prosperous country, a freer country and world, and in many ways a more pure world on many levels. And the second part of the show, the first part, is going to be some stuff that you just don't know about ISIS and what's going over in Iraq and the Middle East that you really need to understand, because there's a much bigger strategy at play and all sorts of subterfuge and the usual lies coming out of the White House and their pigeons at the State Department, and very unfortunately now their pigeons at the Pentagon. I mean, really important stuff. And you haven't heard it anywhere. I flat guarantee you. That's my job. But at the tail end of the show, or the last half of the show, we're going to talk about the invasion of Normandy, the Greatest Generation, what they bequeathed to us, and what we're doing in return. Because what we're doing in return to our kids and our grandkids and their children's children is reprehensible. It's dishonorable. There is no honor in it. And we should be ashamed. Okay, first part of the show. Our friendly little JV group, ISIS. Yeah, okay, Barry, the JVs. So, I want you to understand something about Ramadi. You know, you've heard all sorts of things in the news. I'm not going to go into all that. The Iraqi army cut and run. They left, like, you know, between Ramadi and some other places, 23 heavily armored vehicles of all sorts of different types, from M1 Abrams tanks to mine-resistant MRACs, which they're now using as suicide bombs, etc. And, you know, 70,000 machine guns. I'm not making up that number. 70,000 machine guns. Unbelievable. These are million-dollar vehicles. The tanks are like $5, $6, $7 million. There were 70 of them left behind so far. Yet we can't get any arms to the Kurds, where the Peshmerga has been very successful and are fierce fighters defending their territories from ISIS and from all other comers, too. We can't get them any weapons. We can't get the Ukrainians, who are bravely standing up to the Russians, any weapons, but we can give them to Iraq so that they can either share them with Iran, who's really running their show, or, you know, they can leave them to our buddies ISIS, the JVs. Wow. But here's what you need to know about Ramadi that nobody has told you. And you can pull up a map, and you can follow this with me if you want. So Ramadi, you know, the lifeline of life anywhere on the planet, but particularly its arid regions, the American West, the Australian Outback, the deserts of Africa, and the high plains of Africa, and the Mideast. It ain't oil, folks, it's water. Water. Why do you think the EPA and the Army Corps is making a grab for control of the mud puddles and the runoff from your roof? Because he who controls water controls life. You know, the EPA is like our own little mini ISIS. Anyway, Ramadi, the two rivers in the Mideast are the Tigris and the Euphrates. This is, these rivers have been really the cradle of civilization for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Food, drinking water, life. And he who controls those rivers controls the Middle East. And certainly controls the areas directly, shall we say, impacted by the flow of those rivers. Well, Ramadi is important. Here's what's more important. The dam, very close to Ramadi, that dams the Euphrates. And ISIS controls that now. That's right. Haven't heard about this, have you? No. They don't want you to know, folks. They don't want you to figure out. You know, this was a temporary setback. My butt. This was a huge setback. This setback to our interests in the Middle East and anti-ISIS interests, anti-caliphate, anti-radical radical extremist Islamic barbaric interests, It's kind of like the setback to Hitler on D-Day 70 years ago, 71 years ago. So let me explain this to you. Not only is Ramadi, not only does that give them a clear shot for supplies to make a buildup to do whatever they're going to do from that area, which is only 70 miles from Baghdad. I mean, that's the strategic importance of Ramadi, should we say, to conventional land war. But because of this dam on the Euphrates, they now control the water to Baghdad, the rest of Shiite Iraq, and a large portion of the Middle East. There are 26 gates in this dam. And already ISIS has them all shut off, other than a few, which they open just for a few hours a day, kind of like a little trickle of water just to keep the population alive downstream in Baghdad. Now, you don't think that's disconcerting to the million, couple million, whatever folks that live downstream? Knowing that somebody else is controlling the water, not knowing when they're getting it, how much they're getting? Yeah, try that for psychological warfare. So that's number one. It's a huge psychological blow to the anti-ISIS forces and the Iraqi government. Number two, it throws the Iraqi government into bedlam. Not only the defeat, not only the interjection of Iran, we're going to talk a little bit about that in a moment, that you don't, some stuff you don't know. But it completely misdirects and diverts the government from running its oil industry, which is the only thing that keeps that country afloat financially. And that has some interesting plays with the Kurds, the Peshmerga, that you're not being told about. And we're going to get into all that here over the next 10 or 15 minutes of me yakking here at the microphone. Because it's pretty fascinating. And you know what? On the part of ISIS, it's strategically brilliant. These people are anything but JVs. Anything. The JV, the star JV, and that's giving him a compliment, is in the White House. And he's a JV on purpose. All right. So, if Iraq can't run its oil, it starts starving for cash. And it's a very complicated oil process by which Iraq gets its cash and interrelates with the Kurds, and who have a very rich oil field in their province. And how they interrelate with the major international oil companies that do the work, that get the crude out of the ground. In addition to the psychological and financial impact of taking the dams, the river, of course, with no water in it, is very low. And what does that mean? That means that what used to be just a few points where military vehicles, convoys, major attacks, or even incursions could occur by ISIS across the river into Shiite territory toward Baghdad, now it's not just a few points anymore. They can cross about anywhere they want. And the Iraqi military, which had been kind of massing its forces, not that they wouldn't run, at the points that could be used as crossings, are now spread out over tens and tens and tens, scores of miles. So you take a weak military and stretch it thinner. Basically, you can incur and move and attack wherever you want at will. Rather brilliant. The fourth thing is that what they are doing is they are diverting some of the water from the dam to Fallujah, which is under firm ISIS control. And what does that do psychologically? Let's see. ISIS's enemies don't have water, and ISIS's people do have water. The caliphate has water and the non-caliphate doesn't have water. Gee, where do you want to live? Kind of a basic question, is it not? And the last thing that this does is it gets Iran even more deeply involved in Iraqi politics, control of Iraq, control of Baghdad, control of the Iraqi military, and the Iranian Shiite militias, which are about the only fighting force Iraq has, based on the sterling performance of their army. Can you imagine if the Iraqi army had been leading the invasion of D-Day 71 years ago? We'd all be speaking German or Japanese. So, that brings us to the Iranian influence, which is kind of an offshoot of this Euphrates Dam thing that nobody's told you about, because Ramadi's just, you know, a little bump in the road. And as Josh Earnest would say, we're not going to set our hair on fire over these, you know, little stumbling blocks, these bumps in the road. I mean, you know, it's just a temporary setback. Yeah, okay. General Qasem Soleimani. He runs the Quds Force. They're kind of the quote-unquote elite, the nastiest, most vicious, best trained, most supposedly fierce fighters of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which is kind of like if you put all the services in order, kind of like our Marines to the Army. How's that? As an analogy. Following the fall of Ramadi and the dam, his comment was, quote, the U.S. has not done a damn thing to stop the advance on Ramadi. And of course he's, I hate to give it to the Iranians, but he's exactly right. And we had plenty of chances because intelligence was telling the White House for months that they were massing for an attack on Ramadi. We could have cut off their supply lines any time. But you can't do that when you're flying 7 missions a day scattered over about a 2,000 square mile area. It makes you think about whether or not you really want to, huh? Because you got the planes, you got the bombs, you got the carriers. You're even flying the missions. 75% of the missions don't drop any ordnance because Susan Rice and Ben Rhodes sit up there in the White House and go, oh, no, that wouldn't be a humane target. Oh, no, somebody might get killed. Oh, no, there's people in that building. I'm sure our enemies will give us the same consideration. If the tables, or perhaps we should say when the tables, are turned. So, Soleimani, he went on to say, quote, does it mean anything else than being an accomplice in the plot, unquote. You mean the Iranians are beginning to sense some sympathies by Barry for the insurgents? Or should we call them jihadis? Wow, I've been saying that for a year or two. The Iranians have probably known it for longer. And then he goes on, today, there's nobody in confrontation with ISIS except the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well as nations who are next to Iran or supported by Iran. The expansion of Iranian influence. And you know, you can only expand your influence as a country, whether you're a good country or a bad country, and Iran is a very bad country, if your influence comes at the expense of someone else's. I'll give you 3 guesses at whose expense the expansion of Iranian influence comes. On purpose, by the way. Now, this all ties into a third dimension, which nobody's telling you about. Okay? We have control of water, psychology, military, land movement, Iranian influence, and now we have the Kurds, who are great American allies, or were, except we won't give them any arms. We insist on shipping them through Baghdad, who promptly takes them out and loses them to ISIS rather than giving them to the Kurds, who could do something with them. So the Kurds are up there, and the Kurds are the largest indigenous people on the face of the planet. Think about this. Millions of them who don't have their own country. And there's a big Kurdish faction in Turkey. There's a big Kurdish faction in Iraq. And there's a big Kurdish faction up in the corner of Syria. And the Kurds are allies with some of the other minorities, including the Coptic Christians, those poor ancient folks who have been slaughtered over there in the sectarian tribes around the Kurdish territories that the Kurds have tried to defend, and who they rescued at least partially off that mountain months ago, if you remember that. Without American arms. I mean, these guys are using 40-year-old Kalashnikov rifles against American tanks that ISIS has taken and winning, but we can't give them any support. The Kurds have long wanted to be autonomous, and they kind of got along with Baghdad when the American influence was there, when there were troops there, and, you know, Petraeus was there and all that kind of good stuff. Just as the Sunnis, who helped in the surge in the Ramadi and the Fallujah and the Mosul area, the Sunnis who gave their loyalty to the United States and a democratic and united Iraq, who have been left out to hang and be beheaded and be burned and be killed and be raped by Barack Obama, Susan Rice, the Democrats in Congress, the sniveling fools Barack Obama has replaced in the military, has replaced his top field commanders with in the military. It's absolutely pathetic. It is retching. It is puke city. It is treason. And it is dishonor. To America and to that greatest generation whose greatest victory of many may just have been 71 years ago today on bloody beaches amidst tangled barbed wire in a surf stained red by blood. Tell me, does this piss you off? If it doesn't, you should think about that. So the Kurds have their own oil fields. What they've tried to do, just as they've tried to get arms through the central Baghdad government, they had also made an agreement that their oil revenues would kind of flow to Baghdad and then back to them after payment of expenses, etc., etc. In other words, kind of a voluntary nationalization of their oil resources, with them getting the lion's share after a circuitous route of the money. Well, guess what? With all the stuff going on and the brilliant moves by ISIS and the control of Iran, who doesn't like the Kurds much, they haven't been getting their oil money. And the Kurds are kind of pissed off. And rightfully so. And you know, when you're not getting your money and you're not getting your arms and you're not getting the support, your long-held thoughts of being autonomous come to the forefront. And there is a movement afoot, and you mark my words, that the Kurds of Turkey and the Kurds of Syria and the Kurds of Iraq will shortly, and by shortly, you know, in international parlance, 6 months, a year, 18 months, 2 years, who knows what, but soon, they will be forming their own country. And it will be highly successful. And they will defend it. And they will win. They have all the resources. They've built a thriving community. They've built thriving communities. An excellent, particularly for that part of the world, economy. They have oil revenues. They have a tried and true military who can win even without weapons. It's going to happen. And who knows what consequences that will have. Certainly it will affect Turkey, a so-called ally of the United States and a so-called member of NATO. Certainly it will affect the balance of power in Syria with Assad and ISIS and the Shiites and the whole friggin' mess there that we could have handled 2 years ago with the red line in the sand, but did not. Yeah, there's some interesting things coming our ways. And as I've said often, the next 18 months with Barack Obama and his progressive, traitorous morons in the White House are the most dangerous in the history of this country. No doubt about it, whatsoever. So be looking for Kurdistan, folks. Kurdistan kind of exists right now, but watch it become a much bigger sovereign nation with lots of effects. And as all this has been happening, I'm going to talk more about this next week. We have the Muslim Brotherhood. You remember how the government and Barry and Susan of the It Was All the Video fame, Susan of Bergdahl Served with Honor and Distinction fame. You know, that's Susan. You remember how they told us how the Muslim Brotherhood was so benevolent, so moderate. They're such good friends. Oh, it's so wonderful they've taken over Egypt with President Morsi. And of course, the Egyptians disagreed. 47 million of them were in the streets, and they threw them out along with the military. And Egypt right now is kind of a leader against the fight against Islamic terrorism. It's remained the friend of Israel. A really interesting alliance forming both covertly and overtly between Saudi Arabia, our old friends Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Jordan, Egypt, and Israel. Because they've all figured out they can't rely on Barry and crew. And that's the right decision, too. In any event, we're going to go over the Muslim Brotherhood a little bit next week. But just to give you a flavor, even after the democracy that Barry says he loves, that he lives and breathes for, these human rights, you know, Jim Crow is bad, but the beheadings and the burnings and the rapes over there, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, millions displaced, that's okay. That's cool. You know, nothing we can do about that. Who did you say was getting beheaded? Oh, I got to go play golf. The Muslim Brotherhood, who is in the White House, who advises our security people, who wrote a white paper on how to take over Western civilization from within and through radical jihad, is now showing its colors. They've stepped up terror attacks in Egypt. And they're being coddled and protected by the Obama administration, who still has, in taxpayer paid roles, advisors in the military, in the White House, and in our security apparatus, CIA, FBI, Muslim Brotherhood members. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Valerie Jarrett, who is a Muslim, by the way, and who is born in Tehran, Iran, is not some way, shape, or form associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Maybe Barry, too. Who knows? But they just got out of Egypt a Muslim Brotherhood terrorist. Secured his release and brought him to the United States, telling Egypt to go easy on the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'm going to bring you up to speed on some of the things the Muslim Brotherhood, who is now really showing its real true colors, which have never changed since its inception. You know, they're now calling for a long, uncompromising jihad. That's in January. That, by the way, was a day after Muslim Brotherhood leaders were hosted at the State Department. A day after. They have a movement within the Muslim Brotherhood called the Revolutionary Punishment Movement. In February, they issued a warning that all foreigners and diplomats must leave the Middle East countries by February 28th or be faced with becoming targets in Muslim Brotherhood attacks. Last week, folks, the Muslim Brotherhood published an official statement, English and Arabic, and in it, and I quote, "The revolutionary option with all its means and mechanisms is its strategic choice from which there will be no retreat," talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and radical jihad, and goes on to justify the killing of politicians, judges, security officials, and media personnel, both within and without the Middle East. I could go on, and I will next week. But, you know, these people are the people who are being protected by, coddled by, listened to, paid by, and extolled by our White House. Let's go back to our basic question. Who do you think they want to win and who do you think they want to lose? You're up to date on the Middle East, and you know, that kind of ties in to the overall theme of this show, which began with my reminding you of D-Day and the Greatest Generation, and they're leaving to us a better world. I don't think you can look around right now, and if you handed the keys to the planet to your kids tomorrow, could you look in the mirror and say, really, on an economic basis, and we're going to talk about that in just a bit because it all ties in, on an economic basis, on a prosperity basis, on a jobs basis, on a security basis, on a global stability basis, on a cost basis, and in many respects, even on an opportunity basis, that you're handing the keys to a better planet to your kids today than you received from your parents, the Greatest Generation? I don't think you could. Not if you were honest. You know, Harry Dent, I don't agree with everything he says, but he's a good economist. He has some great ideas. Some a little off the top, but many right on. And he came out with an article in the last week. It was really interesting. It was talking about the slowing of the spending of the affluent. And he projected that slowing, that lack of activity by the affluent, and he defines the affluent as the top 20% of the United States who typically make $100,000 plus, They account for 50% of all consumer spending. And it's that group, folks, that continued spending, albeit at a slightly slower pace, right after and during the recession and this pathetic recovery that we've had. If you even want to call it a recovery, it's all smoke and mirrors. There's been, he goes on in this article, there's been dramatic spending declines throughout Europe because the population is aging, and he explains that. A slowdown in China's workforce and the decline in spending by America's biggest consumer, the affluent, which isn't going to peak for another 5 to 9 years. In other words, they're slowing, is going to spend more, it's slow, more and more and more, with the resulting huge impact to the economy. And shall we say, to the overall health of the planet to which we are handing the keys to our kids. So the affluent control 90% of all financial assets. Did you know that? Stocks, you know, any assets outside of primary homes. First of all, the affluent usually start their spending later than the other 80% of folks. And that's because they're in school longer and it takes them longer to achieve the peak of their income. So most of their spending is done between the ages of 46 and 53. And, you know, that's kind of the, shall we say, median point of the baby boomers. And that median point will all be reaching that magic time of 53 based on these studies, where their spending really, really, really slows because they're on to a different part of their life with different concerns in between 2020 and 2022. But the effects have already been felt. 2014, in 2000, they were 39, this kind of median group of the baby boomers. And spending was somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. This group hit the age of 46 in 2007, this kind of median, shall we say, surge of baby boomers. And spending was about $50,000 per year. And in 2014, this group hit 53. And spending started to drop down to about 45,000. And it's projected to drop as they age to about $30,000 by the time they are 60, $20,000 by the time they are 75, and $10,000 to $20,000, give or take, when they're in their 80s. That's a lot of money that's not being spent, folks. That's a lot of jobs that are not being produced, not being created. A lot of goods and services that aren't moving. Because it's that plateau between the ages of 39 and 53 that's so important. And by 2020 and 2022, argues Dent, that plateau will have passed. He's really basing his economics on demographics. And you know what? I went back and kind of researched some of his stuff and some of his stats. I think he's onto something. We had all heard about demographics and the aging population and all that kind of stuff. But I think he really is onto something.